I am 54. The 29th of April, 2007 to the 28th of April, 2008. Above. Driving North by Andrew Taylor. It's April the 29th, 2007. Driving North is a curious thing. After Forton services on the M6, the road starts to quieten. There's something about this open road that makes the drive welcoming, easy. There's a light left. On the passenger seat, an old map wallet bought in Bordeaux is filled with maps of Galloway, including the 1925 Ordnance Survey map of Newton Stewart. I take the A75 after breakfast. The sea has that sheen of early spring. I arrive in Newton Stewart early. As I cross the bridge, the River Cree is flowing fast. My destination is the Penkiln Burn that feeds the River Cree. Taking a left through Minnegaff, past the Cree Bridge House Hotel, I'm on familiar ground. I'm on my way to the cairn overlooking Garlis Wood. When I bump into a couple walking the same way along the track, I recognise their Scouse accents. I've just come up from your neck of the woods. Oh yeah? Where's that then? The lad replies a little sharply. Liverpool! Hang on, aren't you Bill Drummond? His demeanour changes and he turns to his girlfriend. This is that fella I was telling you about. Bill Drummond used to manage the Bunnymen and the Teardrops. He's from around here. The woman, a little bemused, says, oh yeah? It's not clear whether it's a question or a comment. We walk along the burn together. I disclose the reason I'm back in Scotland. I'm chasing the White Hart of Galloway, the semi-mythical deer that roams Garlis Wood. Every time I visit Newton Stewart, I wander to the cairn with my gas stove, make a pot of tea and sit and wait, eyes northbound, to Pete Riggs Strand, camera ready. The White Hart is the final piece in a puzzle that began in 1978. The first piece was to get Echo and the Bunnymen to play the Western Isles of Scotland, which was achieved in 1983. The second was the completion of the Bunny God Psycho Race in Liverpool, May 1984. To close the puzzle, I need to spot and photograph the White Hart of Garlis Wood and flypost the picture around Liverpool for its stint as European Capital of Culture next year. The artwork is to be of the White Hart on a sterilised milk bottle label. The puzzle will then be complete. July 26th, 2007. I've been reading about a writer from the 1960s. Don Carpenter's second novel, Blade of Light, has become something of a quest. The book has long been unavailable, commanding a hefty second-hand price tag. The music lover in me sees this as a mission, like tracking down an original copy of Scott 2 or Scott 4. You know, those charity shop finds that stop you in your tracks. I use the New York Times website and search through their archives to find out more about Carpenter. This made my interests in Blade of Light peak. Carpenter tasted some kind of fame by ending up in Hollywood writing screenplays. Sounding like some kind of noir figure, he made his final statement by killing himself 2 years ago. Through that lad, Andy, who walked the burn with his girlfriend in Newton Stewart, I learned of a way to get a hold of Blade of Light. It involved Liverpool musician and writer Nick Power and a university library. Turns out Andy and Nick collaborated on a book of poems, Lodeen Chronicles, and Andy had access to a university library and photocopier. The book was borrowed from Trinity College Dublin via interlibrary loans and stealthily photocopied, then photographed. Nick and Andy called it the heist. Blade of Light is a lot like the Bunnymen's Heaven up here, dark and mysterious. August 27th, 2007. I wake in the middle of the night after a strange dream. I'm back in Liverpool in the orange Bunnymen transit van, picking some gear up from Will's dad's house in Melling. Driving past the playing field, Les pulls over. There's a gang of lads playing football. One is Les's cousin, Andy, and his mates, Andy, Graham, Sniff and Jeff. We stop at Les's auntie's house for a cuppa, and his uncle gives him a Meccano toy that was his as a kid. Mac picks the toy up and begins to dismantle it. He looks around and asks for a spanner. When the spanner arrives, Mac holds it like it's landed in the hands from out of space. I've been thinking a lot about writing The Heist and Blade of Light. I've been reading through digitised versions of old poetry magazines online. A favourite is Second Eon, published in Cardiff in the 1960s and 1970s. That's when I start to think about connections and how Liverpool is at the centre of a shining vortex. Poet Allen Ginsberg said in 1965 that Liverpool is, at the present moment, the centre of consciousness of the human universe. In the final issue of Second Aeon, the poems of Matronal Vavin appear, translated into English from French and originally the Russian by Clayton Eshelman and put into mind of Julian Cope's song, Matronal Vavin. It's no accident that Copey knew that Matrinal dreamt of becoming a neon. October the 12th, 2007. Armed with the photograph of the White Hart that I managed to take at Garley's Wood, I take to my workshop. The plan originally was for posters to be pasted in towns along the M6 to Scotland and the A75 to Newton Stewart. But painting has preoccupied me of late. I prep the board, 92 centimetres by 122 centimetres, and paint the outline of the tall, sterilised milk bottle. The label is based on Les Pour Stérilés de Vingian by Theophile Alexander Steinen. The brand name is Matronal Vavin, and the label features a posse of cats looking up at Vavin, who sat in front of the White Hart. The 28th of April, 2008. I'm back at the cairn in Newton Stewart with my camping stove, backpack, shovel and the following. The sterilised milk bottle painting, the photocopies of Blade of Light, Lodeen's Chronicles and a metal box. I take some time to take in the view. Peat Ring Strand is greening. The birds are singing. It is serene. I walk 10 paces north by northwest to the cairn and begin to dig.
Below, Is This the Truth? By Eleanor Roberts. Something wasn't right with this year, and I couldn't figure it out. As I drove up from London, I heard another sound from the Land Rover, something new, something that was dragging me down, a foretelling of something mechanical maybe, but somehow it seemed more mystical than that. When I first saw them in sky, it was all smiles. Though the rain was coming down fast, the teenage girls were belting out a T-Rex song as their dad cycled ahead of them, all three in waterproofs against the downpour. We passed them slowly, but as I looked in the rearview mirror, the rain and their waterproofs had gone, and sunshine showed three younger people. One kid barely 10, the other nearer 7, the dad now a man in his late 30s in jeans and a red Guinness T-shirt. They waved, and we stopped. The bikes had disappeared. "Do you want a pineapple juice?" said the younger one, proffering bottles to us as if it was the elixir of untold promises. We drank them, still on a high from the mountain. It was tart and sweet at the same time, and as I finished mine, the bottle spewed forth the cold smoke of dry ice, and the girl giggled in delight. The older one, though, stared at me and didn't move or laugh all this time. Under her breath, I heard her say, "It was you, wasn't it? It was you, not us." And the young one stopped, and her smile turned to a frown, then a face so full of hurt it could kill the world. I didn't know what I'd done. I didn't know what to say. "Do you need a lift?" I asked them tentatively, as we were in the middle of nowhere, and they now had no apparent transport. I looked around the back of the Land Rover to see where we could make some room, but when I looked up, they were gone. "What was that all about?" I asked Patterson and Balfour. But they'd been asleep all the time, and I was inside the Land Rover, and it was raining again, and there were no pineapple bottles in sight. Next time I saw them, I was in a lay-by, staring under the hood of the Land Rover without a clue as to what was wrong with it. There was no other car, but when I looked up, the father was beside me with a battered blue toolbox. He was angrily ignoring the girls who were sitting on a verge. The little one was crying at me with her huge brown eyes, and the older one was shouting, "You have to tell him! You have to tell him that it was you who broke it and not us!" "I didn't do anything," I protested. "It just made an awful noise and shuddered to a stop." But as the AA man pulled up and I waved at him, they were once again gone. After that, I saw glimpses of them everywhere, always running, happy as anything, until they spotted me and then stood sad, wounded, and it was all my fault. But they would never tell me why. I handed out bunches of daffodils, and one was snatched off me. "You are not a good man if you don't tell the truth," they shout, but again and again. I don't know what the truth is. It's November, and they've all turned up to the 17 gallery. The girls, teenagers again, talked to me as if we'd never met before, and the dad said he thought he knew me from somewhere, and in that moment I knew him from somewhere long ago at a time when I was the one running away. The girls, the older versions, sang with a wild keening that I recognized as the new sound of the Land Rover, the sound that had been haunting me for months. Somehow life was cascading, and will keep cascading until I find out what I've done and how to make it right. Winter into spring is spent worrying about my imminent death and how to make things right. And as I pore over the pages of my book and try to pinpoint how I have done these children wrong, I get dressed and walk into the lobby And there is a woman in her late 30s, sitting drinking tea, and there's something about the brown eyes that I recognise, so I ask if I can join her. It was the year it all started to go wrong, she explained. 1977. We went from being endlessly happy girls to living in a split house and a dad that came round late and cried, and we were young, and you ascribe huge consequences to minor things that are forgotten by every adult involved, but held on to by children as the root of all that is bad. Small things that are huge things, like being told you can never run around by yourself again in your giant round playground because it was you who ate the second cup of peanuts when you'd never had a first, and it was your fault you were sick in a bin when the adults should have been supervising what went in our mouths, and it was you who broke the toilet bowl. But it wasn't us. It was you. And when we looked around, you were gone, and it was just us standing there, and that was the end of that magical time, and we thought it was because of us he had to leave. But of course, it wasn't. It was because of something dull and adult, a crooked manager, the frustration and boredom of a cast-aside man, all these things concealed from a child, never discussed, never told. So you hold on to the only thing you know, the accusations of wrongdoing, and you spend your life trying to put them right, even if this itself is not the truth.